It's time to talk birding with our regular guest, Bill Volkert. I'm Keely Boltina. Thanks for joining us here on the Ideas Network. Bill is a retired wildlife DNR educator and naturalist. He worked at the Horicon Marsh for 27 years and has been watching birds for well over 40. And he's the author of a number of books on the subject. His latest is called Journey of a Thousand Lifers. We have plenty of opportunities to do some bird watching in the winter, and Bill has some suggestions for where to go. What do you want to know about finding birds? Join this conversation. Call 800-642-1234, or you can send an email or a photo to ideas@wpr.org. Bill, thanks so much for coming in.
Oh, my pleasure.
You know, I really want to make sure time is moving so quickly that we get to the Christmas bird count. For those not familiar, catch us up. What is this?
Well, it is actually the oldest bird survey in the world. Yes. So as we have sort of modernized and developed the science for evaluating bird populations, their ecology, or other wildlife studies, this was actually a very early count that was conducted. Now counting things and measuring things is really part of some of the fundamentals of science. But it began out of an old tradition, and that was back in the 1800s. It was a Christmas tradition for the gentlemen after their dinner to go out, grab their shotguns, and shoot birds. The assumption was that wildlife and our natural resources were unlimited anyhow, so not a big thing. And it was basically a competition to see who could shoot the greatest number and the greatest variety of things.
That is not how we do things today.
No. And you've got to remember that this was coming out of a completely different perspective at the time. In fact, one of the most famous bird artists, John James Audubon, got his specimens by shooting them. But that's because the optics didn't exist at that time. And our idea of wildlife abundance was quite different. It was considered to be an infinite resource. What really triggered, I think, a change in people's mind was the extinction of the passenger pigeon. Considered to be probably the most abundant bird to have ever lived in North America, when we saw that disappear, I think it was not just an awakening, but if that bird can disappear, nothing else stood a chance unless we did something to deliberately take care of them. That's where the conservation movement grew out. And out of this conservation movement and a sense of finite and delicate resources came a sort of a mind shift, too, of how we deal with wildlife. And so it was then in 1900 that Frank Chapman suggested, we shouldn't be shooting birds. Let's count them. And he organized through some local bird clubs these counts, and that's where it started. And it began sort of as just an outing for people, a recreation, and a new way to approach this Christmas tradition. And with that, we started to realize there also is some really valuable data that's coming from it. And so it became a standardized survey. And so nowadays, the surveys are done within a 15-mile diameter circle. So it's a designated area. There are hundreds of these across the United States. There are over 80 in Wisconsin alone. And we conduct them during a period of roughly mid-December to early January, so the 14th to the 5th. It used to be the second Saturday of December, which was somewhat variable. In the last 10 years, they decided to come up with uniform dates. And the nice thing about it is this is a time of year when bird populations are relatively stable. We're well past the migration for most things. Birds have kind of settled in for the winter. And so with that, it gives us a pretty accurate count of what resident birds are sitting around and distributed across the continent. And we can also take a look at annual shifts in bird populations, where they may move east-west as numbers may go up and down, or any other variations even over time. And so with this now being almost 120 years of tradition, we've got a very long-term data of bird populations, which is really just one more data set of all the other things that we're now using to evaluate bird populations.
Some of our listeners may not have participated in a Christmas bird count. I will admit that I haven't. I mean, what can we expect? What do we do?
Okay. If you want to join in a Christmas bird count, first thing to do is get in touch with one of the coordinators, and you can do that. You can just take a look at the Christmas bird counts that are online through the National Audubon Society, who coordinates them, or you can also go for the Wisconsin counts, look a little more directly to the Wisconsin Society for Ornithology, the statewide bird group. Look at their website. That's WSO Birds. and you look under Christmas bird count, and then you can find a count in your area. Now, if you want to participate, there's a lot of, again, ways to participate. Mm-hmm. I would say for somebody who's never been on one before, even bring the family along, get the kids out there, and join somebody who has experience in conducting the count, with watching birds, knowing where to go, and maybe just go out even for a few hours or a half a day and just bundle up a bit and just see mm-hmm. what birds are doing out there in this dead of winter time. For those people who don't want to venture out, if you are within a count circle, you can also count what comes to your backyard bird feeder.
Oh, fancy.
So you can just sit by the kitchen window, grab a cup of coffee, and just periodically look out and tally the birds. One little reminder of that is you basically write down the variety of birds and the maximum number you see. We don't want people counting the same chickadee over and over and over again every time you show us every 15 minutes.
Fair. So, I love that.
Yeah, if you tell us you saw 1,000 chickadees at your bird feeder, that might be a little questionable.
Right, right. And so, yeah, absolutely. And I appreciate the invitation for the family, although mine are pretty loud. So I don't know if that would help or hurt when trying to count with some loud kids around.
Well, it also teach them a little bit
there
just to
go.
Appreciate nature.
Yeah.
You know, you can talk as you walk around and so forth, but when you've come across a flock, it's time to be quiet. Open your ears and your eyes and use your senses, and now take a close look what's there, because obviously that noise will disturb the birds and may flush them before you get a chance to get a close look. And the other thing about whether it's a Christmas bird count or just a spring hike or watching birds in your backyard, there's always that sense of discovery. Just to see what's out there in nature, to see some familiar ones like a brilliant cardinal on a nice winter morning, or to see something new, maybe something that you haven't been aware of before, and to discover that. So I think there's really that opportunity in watching birds and wildlife.
Yeah, there's some real wonder there.
Mm-hmm. And the other thing I always find is interesting about watching birds is if you follow the birds, they're going to take you to some very scenic areas. There's a reason to get out of the house, to get out into the woods, to just get out where they live.
We'll get into that in just a second. We're talking with Bill Volkert, retired wildlife DNR educator and naturalist, and we're talking about birds. Bill can take all questions. He's got some suggestions for where we can go, but we want to know what you want to know about finding birds. What have you tried? Has it been successful? Join this conversation. Tell us what you're seeing. There's a line for you at 800-642-1234, or you can send an email, even include a photo if you've been able to snap one. The address for that is ideas@wpr.org. Big question, Bill. What are the best places to find birds this time of year?
Well, winter is, of course, a somewhat restricted time for wildlife. It gets difficult. The vast majority of our birds have migrated out, so populations and the variety is certainly at a low point right now. But birds do hunker down in favorite places. For those traveling around Wisconsin, if you're just taking a look at different areas, first of all, open water is certainly attractive for any of the water birds. And a lot of our lakes are freezing up, but much of the Mississippi remains open, portions of the lower Wisconsin River, the Great Lakes, and quite a few bird watchers hit along the harbors along Lake Michigan. There's an area for each of those major towns, the port towns, where we can find any variety of birds. The greater and lesser scaup, common ducks might be out there. Some of the northern migrants, such as the scoters and long-tailed ducks, might come down. Gulls, well, that can be a little bit more challenging to identify. A lot of ringbill and herring gulls, but we may get some unusual ones. Greater or lesser blackback gull, Iceland gulls, glaucus gulls. These are birds that may mix in with the flock, and for a little bit more of the advanced bird watching, sort through all the gulls and try to look for some rare ones. Forest birds, well, anywhere you've got trees, southwest Wisconsin, northern Wisconsin, some nice forests where we can find anything from the variety of woodpeckers, the hawks. This is not a really good year for the finches. Goldfinches will certainly be here, and house finches, those are resident birds. But the reports out of Canada this summer and fall was that the conifer trees have a wonderful corn crop. So it's really so much food is available in Canada, the birds aren't coming south.
They just stay, where the food is.
Yes. Mm-hmm. So pine siskins and red poles, purple finches, these are not expected to make a big invasion into Wisconsin this year, so they may not be showing up. Other places to be watching birds, as I mentioned, along the Great Lakes, the North Woods, Those are always good spots. In January, there'll be the Eagle Watch, both on Mississippi and Wisconsin River. And it's more productive the colder the winter. And the reason for that is as more and more ice forms on the river, the only open water is right below the dams. And so that concentrates the eagles there. And it'd be some really good watching. There's always some to be seen. But yeah, the more open water you have, the more they're scattered out for miles downstream below those dams.
Mm.
But those are great events.
And we know that bald eagles love the Mississippi during the winter. What about golden eagles? Are they coming?
Yeah, that's interesting. The young bald eagles and golden eagles can be a little difficult to separate in the field. And so it takes a little bit of training. Our bald eagle, everybody knows them for their white head, white tail. They don't acquire that until they're, say, roughly 4 or 5 years old. So there are these immature plumages with a greater or lesser amount of white speckled in the underwing is one of the better field marks for them. And that can look somewhat like the young golden eagles. And golden eagles tend to be more common in the Western Plains states and up into Canada. But as bird watchers have been looking more carefully at eagles in Wisconsin, we find that especially in the western part of the state, there are golden eagles that are showing up. And people have been going to, Devil's Lake, for example, has been a place where one has been seen recently. And just driving some of the back roads off the Mississippi River, there's some scattered populations that hunt there. And it's an interesting challenge to both separate them, and we're also starting to get a little bit of data that does indicate that golden eagles do come to Wisconsin, not in huge numbers, but maybe 15 or 20 of them or so are hanging out.
And so if you spot one, that's really exciting.
Yes, it's always good news. And we are starting to get a little bit of a tally in finding out that golden eagles are not as rare in Wisconsin as we once thought. It is a winter visitor.
All right. We do have an email in to ideas@WPR.org. You can send your question or your comment. You can also give us a call at 800-642-1234 if you've got a question for Bill. We have Rich in Green Bay who sent in a photo of a bird that he found in his driveway on Lake Dubay. Rich is wondering, is it a nighthawk? It's longer than a dollar bill. It's dark with some lighter colorings here. What do you see there?
Well, I'm trying to get a perspective on the picture. It looks like a bird that had been somewhat decapitated. If I can see the picture clearly enough, it looks like the two wings on each side and the main portion of the body has been taken from predator. That wing pattern, the wing is somewhat ruffled up and I wouldn't say completely damaged, but enfolded. But yes, it does seem to have somewhat that pattern. If I could see the bill a little bit better of the bird's head, would be a good indicator. But yeah, there's a good possibility that it would be nighthawk, depending on the time of year he found it, because they tend to leave Wisconsin as we get into early mid-August. So they're late August, early September. So they're pretty early migrants, and they're all the way down into Central America at this time of the year. So this would have been something he would have found back in, late summer already. So yeah. I'm not quite sure when that picture was taken.
Yeah. What do we need to know about nighthawks in Wisconsin?
A nighthawk is a bird related to the whippoorwill. They're in a large family that people call nightjars. Kind of an odd name.
I like that.
Yeah.
That'll work for me.
The old name nighthawk, well, it's not really a hawk, but we do see them sort of soaring around like falcons do, but they're snapping the large insects out of the air, especially moths and large beetles. So they tend to feed right around dusk and into the evening hours. And this is a bird population that has really shown steep declines throughout much of its range, and especially in Wisconsin we notice it. The migrations in that late summertime, they're always a thrill to see, but we're not seeing quite the abundance. And more telling is the summer distribution. We just don't have the nesting birds in Wisconsin, so these migrants we're seeing are probably coming down from southern Canada in that late summertime. I remember back in the 1980s, I could hear them above the streetlights in Fond du Lac, West Bend, and other cities like that. They were nesting on top of the roofs. Milwaukee had nesting population, and it's been, first of all, changes in those roof designs. Instead of having the gravel, they've gone to tar, which basically would bake the eggs, so it's unsuitable. So they nest on open type of substrate, you know, open ground. So like, say, a gravel bar or a little opening in a field somewhere. And so these gravel rooftops were actually a pretty good thing for them. But as the architectural designs changed, that chased them out of there. And there may have been other impacts within the environment, perhaps contaminants in the food chain. We're not quite sure what's going on. Maybe there's something also happening on the wintering ground in the tropics that could be affecting. We're not certain. And that's the one of the real problems, is that it probably isn't a single cause and effect. So
it's a variety of factors that are contributing.
Yeah. So we're noticing the decline, and that's where your monitoring begins, whether it's a Christmas bird count, breeding bird surveys, or any other monitoring we do. We take a look at how many birds are out there and where they're distributed. If we start to see changes, then the question is, what's the cause? And when we think back about the rapid decline of eagles and ospreys and peregrine falcons and their tremendous recovery, that was actually pretty easy because it was DDT. We had that in the environment.
Right.
It led to thin eggshells. They couldn't incubate the egg successfully. They were cracking under the adults. They weren't raising young to replace them, and populations went down. We got rid of the DDT. They recovered, and that was it. These others are probably multi-pronged types of problems for them. So it's not a single cause and effect, but a host of environmental changes out there. And then it makes it much more difficult to put your finger on it, and also harder to come up with some corrective action.
Yeah. And as you mentioned that you were used to hearing nighthawks, Tyler was able to bring up a nighthawk call. Let's listen to what it sounds like. Does that sound familiar to you, Bill?
Yeah, that nice little painting sound. As I say, I still can remember just after sunset standing in the downtown areas of a number of medium-sized cities in Wisconsin and hearing them and actually watching them feeding right above the city lights because they attracted the insects. But there's just been this loss of those birds. We just don't hear that sound out there as we used to. And it's been quite a shame.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, we'll keep talking about birds, both the challenges that they face and the opportunities we have to see them. This is the Larry Mueller Show. I'm Keeley Boltina. Bill Volkert stays with us here in studio, and he's ready for your questions. What birds have you spotted, and how do you find the best birds this time of year? Give us a call at 800-642-1234 or email ideas at WPR.org. And when you want to hear more about our guests or show topics, check out our new blog. Just go to WPR.org/Larry to see what's there. Our conversation continues in just a moment. We'll be right back. We're talking birds here on the Ideas Network. I'm Keeley Boltina. Longtime naturalist and retired wildlife DNR educator Bill Volkert is here, taking your questions, talking with you about your thrills when bird watching. We'll get to some conversation with our audience in just a minute, but Bill, it's been cold. It's cold outside. We've had cold early this year. How is that affecting the birds in Wisconsin?
Well, overall, it really doesn't affect them that much because those that aren't able to find food, especially those that feed on insects in summertime, they've left.
Okay.
And those that do remain are well adapted to the winter weather. And it always astounds me that when we step outside for even a few minutes, how much we have to bundle up, how raw that is, and we can't wait to get back in. And the birds live out there 24 hours a day and have to sleep through those long nights without food. But yet there are a lot of adaptations that allow them to do that. And, of course, we can offer food for them. Brachyard bird feeders are certainly a way to attract the birds. But our studies do indicate that the vast majority of the food that birds acquire, even around places where there are bird feeders, most of it comes from the wild.
Huh.
But when the weather gets really severe with storms, it can be a lifeline for them. And so in a way, probably most of the bird feeding we do is for us, so we can see them, enjoy them, and have them around. But it may be important when those storms come in. But we had very early cold weather, record weather, in record cold in early November. The good news was that while that was extremely early for us, it was also well enough into late fall that the migrants were already gone. So we really had, for the most part, our winter birds here. And for them, that's nothing. If you think back last year, southern Wisconsin, we had temperatures less than 20 below. Northern Wisconsin, 35 below. And overall, birds seem to fare fairly well with that. The important thing is that wildlife can really survive most of those kinds of events, and especially the regular seasonal events, they always have. The main thing now is they've been able to survive in those natural environments and the resources that nature provided. But as we convert more and more of that and squeeze them, basically that drama that plays out in nature has a harder time to really continue the normal type of activities as that stage gets smaller and smaller. And so with that, as we constrain wildlife to smaller areas, it gets harder for them, and we're adding other pressures. And perhaps that's one of the many different factors that are affecting some of these populations. The obvious one is just habitat loss. There's less places to live, which means there's less birds of those species that need those places. But it's also the quality of that environment. Contaminants, we know that the new studies on the neonicotinoid pesticides, they are having a variety of effects from our honeybees to birds and their inability to gain weight if they're eating the contaminated seeds treated with that. We also take a look at, say, the evidence coming out on just insect populations, especially from Europe. They saw a 60% decline in aerial insects. And I think most people would recognize, you drive around in summertime, we just don't splatter the insects on our windshield the way we used to. Hmm. They're just not out there in that density. And so that means there's less food for the birds that both relied on them and were the natural insect control. And my feeling is this, that we have declared war on insects as a pest for our crops. And we've tried all kinds of things to throw everything at insects to try to suppress those populations. And we keep changing our chemicals, DDT, while it worked, but it had
catastrophic consequences for the populations.
And so we developed something new. Now the neonicotinoids, now we're trying to take a look at that. Roundup, you know, that's certainly effective as an herbicide. We got all these Roundup ready crops. Well, I think we've been so successful declaring war on insects, we're winning. Mm. Problem is the consequences of that are probably not what we want as an outcome.
Yeah.
So with that, you know, it's the quality of the environment, much less the structure of things out there, the amount of wild places for wildlife. And that's where really we're seeing the results that are so alarming that came out of an evaluation recently published in the journal Science about the massive declines of bird populations in U.S. and Canada.
Yeah, a quarter of North American bird population lost.
2.9 billion birds, breeding birds, have been lost in the last 50 years. And it isn't any one particular family. It's across the board. We're losing birds, just even the common ones are not as common as they used to be. And so it's telling us that we're really starting to stress the environment for a lot of these ecosystems to function effectively. And we don't know what the consequences would be. Certainly there's the aesthetic loss, the inability to be able to see something like that again if we lose it. But what else is going on if it's affecting birds that much? What does that mean for the ecosystem overall and even the world we live in?
That's a pretty heavy question there for sure. We're talking with retired wildlife DNR educator and naturalist Bill Volkert, and we're taking your questions about birds and also taking your stories about what you've seen. 800-642-1234 is the number to call. You can also email us at ideas@wpr.org. When we are talking about feeding birds, Janelle emailed that she has a pair of cardinals that visit her garden to eat off of sunflowers. And Janelle's wondering, are there any plants they can add to their garden to attract bluebirds or blue jays? You know, these are some of those like beautiful, vibrant birds that I just have in my head with the, you know, the stark winter backdrop. Mm-hmm. Are there things that we can put out for them?
Well, bluebirds, we will have a few that overwinter in Wisconsin and are also a fairly early spring migrant. But their food in wintertime is mostly sort of the freeze-dried berries that they're eating on. People have put out mealworms. So you can try that, but you have to have the birds in the area in the first place to really attract them. And blue jays are really just generalists. They will take a whole variety of different food, insects in the summertime, and you know, certainly seeds. They'll even occasionally eat acorns in the fall time. So there's a whole variety of things that may attract them. I think just an active good bird feeding station will provide the food for blue jays. But the other thing that I really want to emphasize is the need to landscape your backyard so we make it attractive for wildlife. Remember, it's a dangerous world out there for birds. There's always a potential of predators lurking even right in your own backyard. And so providing some dense cover, conifer trees, some shrubs, some places where birds can escape to and feel safe, and, of course, also nest during the summertime. This is important. So I find it a little disconcerting when people are in brand new developments and neighborhoods. The house has been built. There's only one or two trees planted there, and they haven't even begun to grow and mature. And you put up a bird feeder and wonder why nothing shows up. Well. You know, it's the three fundamentals for good habitat. It's food, water, and shelter. And sure, your bird feeders are providing the food that may attract them, but they need to feel safe. And we can even provide open water for wintertime for birds. That's another component that can help them.
All right. Sounds good. Let's go to Gordon in La Crosse now. Gordon, welcome to the Ideas Network. Thanks for giving us a call.
Hey, thanks so much for taking my call.
What did you want to talk about today? Yeah.
Well, I've got a real quick comment. I'm not much of a bird watcher, but I'm a construction worker by trade. I've got occasion to go to the La Crosse County landfill maybe once a week or so, and have noticed over the last month that the eagles have pretty much made themselves comfortable. There's literally hundreds of eagles all around the landfill. There's a big hill that abuts it, and if you look up in the trees, you see these white spots everywhere. Each one of them is an eagle. There's literally hundreds.
Wow. Hmm,
interesting. Well, by La Crosse, you've got, first of all, easy pickings in the dump, the landfill sites,
right.
And then you've got the river right nearby.
Right there.
So you've got something that will naturally attract the eagles with the open water, and then you've got easy pickings right nearby if your fishing success is going down. And actually, that might be an interesting site for an experienced bird watcher to go just to do a little bit of assessment of the number of bald eagles versus golden eagles where you're concentrating them.
Right.
Interesting.
Yeah, that would be really fascinating.
Oh, pardon me. A real quick follow-up question on that. What do you suppose the long-term effects of eagles eating like humans would be?
Ooh, that's a tough one. But yeah, if they have access to other food
depends
or
on,
pollution.
Yeah, it depends on the contaminants in the food chain. And, obviously you got to eat, but it's got to be healthy meals. So, there's always a potential when in a landfill, you're kind of dumping everything in there. The chance that some of that stuff may be exposed or providing some other chemicals that get into the food chain. Yeah, there's always that possibility.
All right. Yeah. And let's take a listen to a golden eagle, too, just in case you're able to hear them in addition to seeing them. Does that sound about right, Bill?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Those are normally the calls they'll give around the nest site.
Okay.
Usually they're fairly silent throughout much of the year unless there is direct, say, conflict between them. They're fighting over some food.
Sure.
But for the most part, they tend to be somewhat silent.
And do they make that sound when they are concerned about the nest, or is there a particular...
A communication or contact with a mate.
All right. Mm-hmm. A lot of times. Okay. Yeah. Sounds great. Rick from New Glarus has a question for us, too. Rick, let's go ahead and welcome you to the program. Thanks for the call.
Thanks, Keely and Bill. So, Bill, I've got a follow-up comment for you. I talked to you with Larry, I think it was in August, and I asked for some advice about a fledgling blue jay that we had found on the farm here. And we turned him back to the woods several times, and he kept hopping out and coming towards us. So we picked him up, and we raised him.
Mm-hmm.
And we had asked you how to get him back into the wild. We raised him in a screened-in porch that we had, and it's a kind of a long story, and I'll make it as quick as I can. It was an awesome experience. They're such social creatures. The problem is they bond with humans when you raise them, and they become extremely attached and extremely social, and we had trouble figuring out a way to get him back in the wild. So your advice was to open up the screened-in porch and periodically give him access to the outside, which is exactly what we did.
Right, a slow release.
Mm-hmm. And it worked perfectly. He reluctantly went out and then would stay outside all day, but then he would come back wanting to be fed and come back into the screen-in porch and we'd feed. And finally, after about a week or so, he'd spend a night or two out, but it's kind of a funny story that he comes back one morning and brings two or three small woodpeckers with him, and they're all inside the screened-in porch, he wanting to be fed, and they just following him, thinking he knew where the food was, which he did. But anyway, it's kind of a sad story, and there's a lesson learned for us. He would come, we would go outside, and he would come out of the trees and come and land on our shoulder, and basically had bonded so extensively with us. He, at one point, we were changing a bird bath, and he, before we could change the water, he jumped in and took a bath, couldn't fly up into a tree, and flew into some underbrush cover. There happened to be a feral cat in there. It jumped on him.
Yeah. Shoot.
Anyway, so the lesson learned is they do imprint very heavily to humans. They're wonderful creatures and very social, but I think it's to their detriment. So I guess your advice was right on the money, and he went back. Had not he been killed at that time, I think he would have been okay as he progressively joined back in. And so my penance on this is now I've subsequently learned that they absolutely love in the shell unsalted peanuts. I've taken a 5-gallon bucket lid, turned it upside down, and put it on a perch outside that screened-in porch, and I fill it with peanuts by about 9 in the morning in a cold night. That tray is had 200 peanuts, and it's gone by about 9 in the morning.
It's a soft shell. They can get into them pretty quickly, can't they?
Rick, it sounds like you did everything you can. You know, we are dealing with wild animals here, Bill.
Yes, and I do remember talking about this with Rick earlier. I should mention that federal laws prohibit people actually taking wildlife in. And, yes, that imprinting like that. I know we're well-intended, and sometimes we need to intervene when something – you know, like this, you know, is a fledgling that adults may have abandoned or been lost. But there are licensed professionals that that deal with that. But the more we interfere with wildlife, the less they have a chance to actually learn how to live in the wild. And so, we're best off to watch from a distance.
Yeah. We've been talking about insects and how those relate to birds. Ron in La Crosse has something to say here. Ron, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, I go back to the 1950s. I live in La Crosse River Valley, and I remember there were so many insects, moths, dragonflies, mayflies, that some motorists actually put screens in front of their car grills to prevent grill kill. You know, because moths are rather unsightly on your car grills.
You still get the big hatches of the mayflies out of the Mississippi River. Just like Lake Winnebago gets its lake flies. So we still see that. In fact, those can be so abundant as an eruption, they pick them up on Doppler radar. But as you say, that overall aerial insect population has been a real noticeable decline. And it's certainly taken a lot of food away from the birds that depend on it.
Yeah, absolutely. Lee from Green Bay then. Lee, welcome to the Larry Mueller Show. What's on your mind?
Yes, good morning. I just want to make two quick comments. I find that heated bird baths in my yard are real important for the birds during the real, especially the real cold weather. And my other comment is I'd like to ask Bill how it's affected our robin population with this disgusting practice of lawn care and all of the poisons we're putting into the environment.
Well, there again, it's a hard one to evaluate when we're looking at the contaminants in the environment, whether that's outrightly affecting the worm population or the insect larva that might be in a lawn alone just through the lack of food, or what may be even more so contaminating through the food chain. The only way that we can really be sure of that would be have to sample a few individuals. In other words, take some out of the wild and do some tissue analysis of them. And so that would be a bigger study, and it would be for the wildlife health labs to really look at that. I still remember in DNR when we would find, say, a report of a number of ducks that were dead. While it may look obvious to you what might be the cause or certain diseases that we know that may break out in waterfall, it was never conclusive until the laboratory actually did its formal analysis and could tell us. Otherwise, you're just guessing. And so I think that does leave us until there is a formal study that's really done where we would have to take a few individuals from the wild and perhaps different populations around the state and take a look if there's a trend, contaminants building up. Usually they are in some of the organs like the liver, kidneys, fat tissue, things like that. I guess we're guessing a little bit what's happening. Robin populations seem to be fairly wide distributed yet and doing fairly well. You know, I guess I would be concerned about, you know, contaminants for any wildlife. But if I look at Wisconsin birds, there are others I'm far more concerned about than robins. Just robins are one we relate to well because they're so widely distributed. Mm-hmm. Everybody sees them.
Yeah, they're really present. Lee, are you seeing less of them in the area of Green Bay?
Not as many as I used to. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Well, again, the study that did the evaluation of North America's birds found that even among the common birds, there are declines. The one thing I would really caution people of is just what we're seeing in our backyards and our neighborhood is not a good way to assess what's happening with bird populations overall. We've had this experience in past programs where, when I was on this summer, somebody was talking about just not seeing hummingbirds in their backyard that summer, what's happening to them. And as other people called in, we found that, well, they still had their hummingbirds. It was just that individual did not see them come. So just that individual experience is not a reflection of the bigger population. In the same way, I would say, again, working from DNR, I remember during the deer hunting population and when chronic wasting disease broke out and we were out sampling at the registration stations, there were a lot of hunters who tried to tell me what the entire regional deer population was doing from what they were seeing out of their tree stand, whether it was a great morning or whether it was a bust for them, and assuming that that was sort of a population-wide trend.
Yeah.
So when we look at this data, and this is something I would like to add to it, is this was an evaluation of surveys of birds done over the last 50 years. And it was not just a single data set, but even looking at the radar data, which has only been since 2007, even there we're seeing in migration a less volume of birds than we did, say, 15 years ago. So there was a whole accumulation of data. But for myself, watching birds in the field, I really can't say if I'm seeing more or less of anything except for some, you know, real notable ones like the nighthawks or the whippoorwills, a few that have shown almost catastrophic decline and wholesale disappearance from parts of our state. Others, well, I'd say during migration, you have good spring years, you have poor spring years, you might see a couple of one year, you might not see them the next. That's not always indicative of a population trend. It could maybe be just the weather itself, you know, or that event for the year, or if a population like the hummingbirds, you have a pair or two in your backyard or you do not. So those individual experiences are not a good reflection. That's why we need the science to take a continent-wide evaluation. And that's where it's really alarming.
Yeah. Lee, thank you for that call. And I mean, it reminds me that we kind of take this a little bit personally, right? Mm-hmm. Like there was always that owl that lived in the tree outside my grandma's house and you could hear it for years and years and years and suddenly you didn't. And it feels like, well, we've done something wrong or something big must have changed. And it's one animal who happened to be there.
Well, and it could be, perhaps there were some changes in the landscape where those birds had a territory and they were forced to mm-hmm. abandon because the land changed right in your neighborhood. But it doesn't mean that owls across the entire state are starting to decline or disappear. Still, it doesn't mean that we shouldn't be concerned because, you know, each little area of habitat does add up as, you know, critical areas for wildlife.
Yeah, good perspective to have for sure. Bill Volkert is a retired wildlife DNR educator and naturalist. He's with us talking about birds this winter, the author of a number of books. And we are continuing this conversation. You can give us a call at 800-642-1234. You can also email us at ideas@wpr.org. And a reminder, if you missed part of the show and want to hear it again, you can always go to our archives at WPR.org/Larry to hear recordings of the broadcasts. You can search by topic and date, and they even go back for years. So you can listen to this program and many others. But we are continuing this conversation right now, and there's a line for you at 800-642-1234. Tell us about the birds you're seeing right here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to the Ideas Network. I'm Keely Boltina, and we're talking about birds with Bill Volkert. He's a retired wildlife DNR educator and naturalist, worked at Horicon Marsh for 27 years, and says he's been watching birds for well over four decades. You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. And let's go ahead and bring Mike into the conversation right away here. Mike, what do you want to talk about when it comes to birds right now?
Yeah, just a quick comment. I'm very much a novice birder, but a few weeks back I was at the Schlitz Audubon Center north of Milwaukee, and I was out hiking in the grassland area there, and I looked in the tree, and there was a kind of a larger bird, larger than a robin. So I took a photo of it, and then a few days later, I actually downloaded it. And I looked at it, and I said, that looks like a shrike, a northern shrike. And so I looked in my bird book, and sure enough, it had that familiar black band across the eyes. And I called up the Schlitz Audubon Center, and they have a naturalist, and they were kind enough to call back and say, yeah, probably, you know, they do have them in the winter. So I lived here all my life, you know, 62 years, that I've never seen the bird. And I remember at the Milwaukee Museum, they had pictures of these birds impaling rodents on thorn trees. And it was just so amazing that I saw this bird. So,
oh, good for you. Excellent sighting.
Yeah, pretty excited.
Yes. Northern shrike is actually a member of the songbird family, but is a predatory bird. And as Mike mentioned, they will impale their prey. Because they're not a true raptor like the hawks and owls are, they haven't got the heavy claws to be able to, first of all, capture and to hold their prey. So they've been known to take larger insects and small mice that they capture, impale them on barbed wire, wedge them between small...
Oh, so they don't use their beaks. They find other things in the
environment.
Well,
they can't hold them with their feet while they're pulling apart with the beak.
Yeah.
So, yeah, they'll actually impale them and then strip them for the food.
All right.
So they've got a very powerful bill. As he mentioned, they're about the size of a blue jay, but they tend to sit at the very top of small trees and have a very horizontal profile, so where blue jays tend to sit a little bit more up and down. But they're very solitary. They nest in the spruce forests of Canada and are a winter visitor here. And as a predatory bird and a winter visitor, they're small in numbers and widespread. The best way I find if I want to look for shrikes is either a random hit and miss or just drive back roads and just start scanning some of the young trees and brushy areas and just look for them. But, I mean, you could put on miles and miles trying to find a single shrike, or you just get lucky to happen to see it. Or the other thing is to know where another bird watcher has already encountered one. But these nature centers, they provide good habitat like Schlitz does down in the Milwaukee area. And those are also great places to watch birds in wintertime because they've got hiking trails, they've got good habitat, and you usually have somebody on staff who either leads a hike or can point you in a good direction.
Sure, and maybe you'll hear them. Let's listen to what a northern shrike sounds like. It's a lot of wind noise there.
Yeah, and just a simple kind of a squeaky call to them. Down here, we don't hear them very much at all. Maybe if there's a reason to be alarmed or something, they may let out a little bit of a screech. But most of that would be the calling that they do around nest sites, which is up in Canada.
All right. Mike from Elm Grove, thank you so much for that call. We do have a couple of pictures in that people have emailed us. Chuck emailed us this photo. What do you see here with this bird at a feeder?
This is a pileated woodpecker, and he's at a suet feeder. So this is a nice way to diversify your food. I always tell people the way to bring in a variety of birds is offer a variety of food.
Okay.
So a mix of seeds, reasonable. Whether it is the cracked corn and sunflowers. We heard earlier about peanuts being very attractive to the blue jays. The black oil sunflower seeds, of course, are very attractive to cardinals and variety of birds. The Niger seed for the smaller finches, and then suet, which is for the woodpeckers and others that'll take it. And this looks a very grayish brown color rather than a rich black color in the back. I don't know if it's the lighting of the camera, but it looks like a young bird of the year.
With that bright red streak right across the top.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And the largest of our woodpeckers, he's about 16 inches, the size of a crow.
Wow.
Always a thrill to see those out
yeah,
in the wild.
Absolutely. And Rebecca sent us a photo, too, of a smaller bird. It's white with some black on its feathers and then a yellow head.
Yes. Otherwise, he should be yellow overall. That is goldfinch, and she's correctly identified it as leucistic, which is generally referred to as partial albinism.
Oh.
It is a lack of pigments in parts of the feathers. It's not a true albino. But, yeah, this is...
So that's why we see the variation.
Yeah, and this will throw
head.
A lot of people for their bird identification when they don't have the right colors.
Sure.
And I've run into birds like that before that, you know, you got to look them over a few times just because they don't have the normal plumage patterns. And you'll have white showing up in places where it shouldn't be. But this can be expressed in almost any bird. There's partial albinism, and it tends to show up more commonly just by the odds of the more abundant birds. Robins, the blackbirds, Canada geese, goldfinches, birds like that, we may notice it in those more often than others.
Well, well done, Rebecca, then, in spotting that and identifying it despite the fact that it's this unique creature. Let's welcome Liz from Amherst Junction now. Welcome, Liz.
Hi there. How are you?
Good. What's your question today?
Well, I have a couple comments about loons.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. I live on a 60-acre lake that just froze about two weeks ago. But in late October, or maybe it was late September, there was a funny-looking loon out there. Our loons left in August. And I got a better look at it. It had a yellow bill.
Hmm. What do you think, Bill?
Well, there are four species of loons in the world. Well, actually five, because they split what was the Arctic loon, Pacific loon. So the North American, Asian populations have been split. But the red-throated loon, our common loon, and then between Alaska and Siberia and the Bering Straits area is the yellow-billed loon.
Alaska, though.
Yeah, that's way out to the
really
west.
Really far away.
We have no documented records of yellow-billed loon actually in Wisconsin. It's a little bit larger, a little heavier bill, and the bill has a slightly different shape to it. Sometimes there is a little difference among individuals in those colors, the age of the bird and condition, and just the individual variations. I would guess, and maybe even the lighting can sometimes affect that. So I would assume that that was just perhaps an unusual coloration on common loon. As I say, I've never heard of yellow-billed loon documented here in the Midwest. We're awful long way away from their range or their normal migratory pathway. So
sure.
To get that far off course for a loon would be incredibly unexpected. But I will also say this, that, I mean, birds do fly. They are pretty regular in most of their migrations, but every once in a while somebody gets way off course, and odd things do happen, and there's always something entirely unexpected in the bird world, and who knows what will show up where.
Right. So, Liz, maybe you tripped across that, or maybe it was a combination of different factors that made it appear to be a little bit different. And loons have different calls. We've got one of them. So if you haven't heard a loon, it tends to be pretty distinctive. Let's try to bring that up here in just a second.
To me, that is that sound of the North Woods in summer evening. It kind of echoes across. They're claiming their territory. You're hearing the two in a duet there. This is that pair bonding and just that haunting echoing. That just makes a wilderness experience.
Yeah, that's really beautiful. I mean, they make some non-beautiful, more aggressive sounds, too.
Yeah, there are four major calls that loons will make that they're really known for. They don't have a lot of variation in their call, but they certainly do have that loud yodeling and that kind of haunting, echoing call like that.
Yeah, but I do love that one. That makes a lot of sense.
They're great.
Let's welcome Judy from Watertown now. Judy, thanks for joining us.
Hi. I am calling about a Cooper's Hawk that is creating havoc in my beautiful menagerie of bird feeding.
Mm-hmm.
He showed up about, I'd say a month ago, and I thought maybe he was just passing through, but I haven't had any of, I had a wonderful selection of cardinals and doves and nuthatches. I mean, it looked beautiful, and all of a sudden, nobody.
Yeah, this is not uncommon. And first of all, it's a consequence of setting up bird feeders that were luring birds in and making it very attractive for a bird of prey. So if you think of it in a natural sense, predator birds, they have to eat too. They always have. And they're picking the easy ones off of the population. With that, they're really not, say, suppressing populations that much. They have to eat as well. I think the sad thing is when people look out their window and their favorite cardinal shows up and all of a sudden he snatched right off the feeder.
Yeah, that's devastating.
Yeah, it gets a little hard to take. Suggestion is this. Shut down your bird feeder for about 2 weeks, 10 days or 2 weeks. Hmm. What will happen is, as I said earlier, birds will find most of their food in the wild anyhow. They'll disperse a little bit. You're no longer luring them in and concentrating them and making it easy pickings for the hawk. As his hunting luck goes down, he'll move on, look for better hunting grounds, and then you can start up again.
Interesting. So just kind of hit pause for a bit. And
a little
see
bit
what
of a pause and let things get back to normal. Let him move on and he can start up again.
Interesting. Yeah. Judy, do you think that's something you could do?
Oh, sure.
Absolutely.
Sure. Sounds like a plan.
Yeah. You'll have keep us updated about what
good
happens
luck with that.
There. Yeah.
That's usually an easy solution.
That's good to know, though, that you kind of, you know, you isolate things and then the Cooper Hawk will move on and then you can kind of hopefully reattract those birds that you loved seeing before.
Right. And when in a way, we've set up a two-stage feeding station. We lure in all the birds with the seed, and that makes it easy for the Cooper's hawk. But as I say, yes, it makes it easy for them, but it's maybe, in a sense, also a little unfair for the birds because we are concentrating them where they're easy pickings. Yeah, just shut it down for a little while, let them move on, and you can start over again.
All right. And, you know, we've got so much to get to here as this conversation continues. We haven't even talked about owls. We've got a lot to say there. And I know we have some more callers who will be ready to go shortly. So before we have to pause for a bit, I just wonder if you have one more place that maybe people haven't checked out that you would recommend they go to and then we can keep going. What should we check out that maybe people haven't thought of?
Well, Devil's Lake for its Townsend Solitaire is kind of a unique area. This is a western bird, and a very unusual little population comes there each year for the wintertime, and bird watchers clamor around the trails there. And the other one I will mention, which I hinted at before, your local nature center.
Okay.
They've always got good habitat, they've got hiking trails, and they're usually very accessible. So they're there to welcome the people, and it's a great place to go.
I love it. Quick hits and lots of answers to your questions here with Bill Volkert as we talk about birds. The conversation continues here on the Ideas Network. I'm Keely Boltina. Thanks for joining us, and we will keep going in just a few minutes. First, here's a little bit of news. Talking about birds with birding expert Bill Volkert today. I'm Keely Boltina in for Larry Mueller. Glad to have you with us here on the Ideas Network. Bill is a retired wildlife DNR educator and naturalist, worked at the Horicon Marsh for 27 years, been watching birds for well over 40. He's also a federally licensed master bird bander with the Bird Banding Laboratory of the U.S. Geological Survey. Do you have questions about a bird that you've seen or maybe a bird feeder question? We'd like to hear from you. You can give us a call at 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Want to bring Helen in West Salem to the conversation now. Helen, thanks for joining us.
Yes, I just was surprised yesterday at a temperature of 10 degrees to see two robins in my bird bath. And I thought, well, did they think it was spring or had they just stuck around?
Did you figure it was too cold for them? Was there water in it?
Oh, yeah. I have heated bird bath water, and it's wonderful because the birds flock there and they love it. But to see two robins, which was really a surprise to me.
Well, most of us think of robin as that first sign of spring, and yes, the vast majority of our robins are migratory, most of them going down to the southern United States. But even as we look back at the Christmas bird count data, especially in southern Wisconsin, probably every year we find robins somewhere, not in huge numbers, not widely distributed, but there's always some subset of that population that does not migrate. And we're hearing
the
spring
right
song of the robin there.
It does sound like spring. It really does.
Yes.
So to see them in December, I can hear that.
Yeah. So they'll stick around, and especially it looks like we had a really good berry crop across quite a bit of southern Wisconsin. So there's a lot of dried grapes that are hanging out there and other food. So food looks like it's fairly abundant, and some birds just simply decide not to migrate. We see the same thing among the flickers, which is a member of the woodpecker family. Most of them migrate, but there's always a few that decide to stick around.
Mm-hmm.
And again, the Christmas bird counts give us an idea of variations from year to year and the distribution of where those birds are found. And it also looks like with the increasingly milder winters, that perhaps we're starting to see more robins sticking around in wintertime than perhaps in the past. Yes.
All right. Well, Helen may have seen some of those birds then that have stuck around at her place.
Not to be expected, but also not completely out of the question to have robins here in wintertime.
All right. Very cool. George from Minocqua now wants to talk about owls. George, tell us about it.
Not to be expected, but also...
Hi, George. I can hear your radio if you want to turn that off. You're welcome to ask your question with Bill Volkert here. All right. We'll try to get George figured out in just a minute. We'll circle back to owls. But let's go ahead and welcome Travis from La Crosse now. Travis, what do you wonder from Bill?
Hi, guys. Thanks for taking my call. I was just wondering, with the recent wrapping up of the Breeding Bird Atlas, if you're... guests had seen the information obtained on that, and what would be maybe the most interesting or alarming numbers or trends that you saw with that information?
I really haven't had a chance to go through the data for all of the different species in the atlas. It is being summed up and getting ready for publication. Let me just explain for everyone else what our Breeding Bird Atlas is. These are projects that started all back already in the 1980s. And as I said, Christmas bird counts are done in wintertime when bird populations are pretty stable. This is sort of the counterpart to that. This is during the nesting season. And these are conducted usually statewide or by a Canadian province for the entire region. And they're done over a 5-year period. So we get good coverage of every different sector around the state. And with that, we're trying to verify the nesting of all the different species of birds. In other words, which birds nest in Wisconsin, how abundant are there, and where are they widely distributed or restricted as an important habitat? And these are also, this is the second atlas go around, so every 20 years we do this. So we then can also see changes in the distribution and abundance of nesting birds. So it's one thing to say watch birds throughout the entire year to see which birds can be found in Wisconsin, but which ones is Wisconsin critical for nesting season and raising their young? And so we just completed the fifth and final field season for this. So the data has all been entered at this point. It's now going to be evaluated and getting ready for publication. And with that, we can then take a look at comparison from the first atlas to see what sort of changes have gone on. Some birds are doing better than they have in the past. Others are not. And we'll see, you know, what those changes are. I should also mention that as they're going to publication, they still could use some money and support for that. So if there's anybody who wants to help to publish that final work, the Wisconsin Society for Ornithology would be collecting those funds. And that will be very important data for us then to take a look at the current state and also the changes. So now we have 20 years to compare a little bit, and then we'll be doing this again in 15 more years. So every, you know, 5 years of field season, and then the chance to sum that up in the 20th year, then to take a look at just what those results are.
Bill Volkert is with us. He is an expert with birds and all things related to that, a former DNR educator and naturalist. I do want to talk a little bit about owls this morning. We have the great horned owl. We have a number of listeners who have called in reporting that they've seen them in their area. What's going on with them right now?
Well, great horned owls, like all of the owls, are quite secretive since they're active at night and hiding back in the woods and roosting during the daytime. We just don't normally see or encounter them, but we can hear them. Great horned owl sound here. Very typical five calls, five hoots.
Interesting.
And it's a... There you go.
Those three right at the beginning,
yep.
And then the last two.
There you go. So that's the typical. There may be some variations of that. The female, when they're calling back and forth, tends to be a little bit higher in her voice. And this is the time of year that they're actually pairing up. They're getting ready for nesting. It is the earliest nesting bird in Wisconsin. They may be on the eggs by the end of January.
Wow.
They're pairing up right now, and they're calling back and forth across the forest as they're getting ready to select the nest site. Typical nest sites may be an old crow or an abandoned red-tailed hawk nest, so an actual constructed cup nest. They don't build their own. They'll just occupy somebody else's work, or a large cavity or hollow in a tree. So those are the most common sites for them.
What about the snowy owl then? I mean, it couldn't have been more perfect. I got to my computer this morning, tried to log in, and the screen that had popped up happened to be this beautiful snowy owl right there before my login.
Always a sight for Wisconsin.
Right.
It is a winter visitor only. They nest in the Arctic. And as we mentioned with the finches earlier, as long as there's food for them, a lot of them stay in the Arctic. But their primary food is lemmings, and they have a population cycle. About every 4 or 5 years, that population crashes. And so when the food is at a low point, they start to move out. Now, we will see some snowy owls in Wisconsin every single year. And that's mostly because as they're raising their young, the adults will hang on to a large territory, forcing the young to move on. And they just search for available areas and oftentimes drift south for improved luck down here. But every, say, 4 years or so, we will get an invasion of those snowy owls. There have been sightings, probably about a half a dozen or so around the state. Some common sites to find them along the Lake Michigan and Green Bay shore is usually good. They hunt along for sometimes the ducks that are sitting there or other food that might be available. The Lake Winnebago area, and especially in central Wisconsin, say south of Stevens Point, those big open sweeps around Buena Vista and around the Horicon Marsh. It looks somewhat Arctic-like and has large wetlands, lake country, and agricultural land surrounding it. So those are some of the better places. But when we have small numbers of them, you've got to find out where the sightings are. You can go to the DNR website and take a look where recent sightings of those birds were.
Oh, so then you can try to see if you can, follow in other birdwatchers' footsteps.
Yes.
And see if you can get a glimpse yourself.
Yeah. Yes.
Oh, how great. Bill Volkert is a retired wildlife educator and naturalist, and we're talking about birds here on the Ideas Network. Also want to mention that the House Judiciary Committee begins considering two articles of impeachment against President Trump, and you can hear live coverage of that on WPR starting at 6 o'clock tonight and online at WPR.org. Just want to make you aware of that as you listen to the Ideas Network throughout your day. Now let's get back to birds. Richard in Milwaukee has a question for us. Richard, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you. This isn't as serious maybe as some of your other questions, but when I was little, like in the 50s, I heard that my great-grandpa, who died even before I was born, that when he was poking his head out of the door of our summer cottage, a bird dropped an egg on his head. And years later, I was wondering, hey, maybe that wasn't an egg. Can birds even lay eggs while they're flying?
Richard, fair question. What do you think, Bill?
Probably more urban myth than anything. I've never heard of it. I've never read of it anywhere. Now, there are cases where birds are in the nesting season, are in a condition where they're ready to lay an egg and may not be at the nest site at that time, and they may dump an egg somewhere else. And so they may be found on the ground. Or what also happens is you have birds that are feeding on bird eggs. So it's not uncommon in springtime to find grackles and blue jays that may take eggs from robins and others. That may be perhaps where the egg fell, that he was flying with something and just simply abandoned the egg shell itself as he dropped it.
All right,
that
Richard.
That would be about the only guess as to
family lore.
How that may have occurred. Perhaps a bird had taken an egg then and just simply dropped it as it was flying.
Interesting situations that might have been.
I have, yeah.
Absolutely. Thanks for the call, Richard. Now let's bring in Christina, who's also from Milwaukee. Christina, thanks for calling.
Thank you. My question is about swimming eagles. I was up in the Boundary Waters and was seeing a bald eagle swimming about 200 yards to shore. And I was just wondering the purpose of that, how common that is, et cetera.
Oh, good question. Yeah, they normally don't swim as such. Now, they're feeding in the open water, trying to snatch fish that are up near the surface. There are occasions where they will somewhat underestimate their food and grab something too large, or they may be trying to reach for something that is heading under the water from the surface and trying to reach a little too deep to grab it before it disappears. Now, when eagles hit into the water, they usually will try to just simply grab it off the surface of the water and keep flying. And that's really just a majestic feeding tactics that they use. But what happens occasionally is that they will fall into the water, especially the young, inexperienced ones that haven't quite mastered it. And when that happens, if they can't get their wings up high enough above that water and be able to then lift themselves out, they tend to get a little waterlogged, and then they have to swim to shore.
Oh.
And so it's the only way to get themselves out, dry up, and start all over again. So, yeah, it was somebody that miscalculated something and ended up out in the water and had to go back to shore the hard way.
Rats.
Yeah.
The hard way is right.
Yeah.
Thanks for bringing that up for us, Christina. Mike from Lake Mills now. Mike, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Hi. I was just wondering we used to have high bush cranberries, and I remember in winter the theory was that we'd get cedar waxwings that would eat them after they'd become fermented and get a little intoxicated.
Mm-hmm.
Have you ever seen that? Number two, I haven't seen any waxwings around this winter. Do they usually hang out?
Cedar waxwings are occasional winter birds. They'll tend to hang around in flocks. The berries is their primary food. So oftentimes the ornamental crabapple trees are really quite attractive for them. It isn't so much the high bush cranberry, but the ones that robins and waxwings tend to, as you said, get intoxicated or get drunk on are the mountain ash. And so in late summer, when those ripen, they may actually ferment on the trees. And so, yeah, that can be the cause of it. Most of our waxwings do migrate and then return again as we get into May. But we will have some winter flocks there again. The Christmas bird counts and surveys are the ones where we'll detect some of those populations, and also the casual watching from bird watchers out there. Usually what we'll find is a flock that comes into some sort of a dried fruit crop during the wintertime.
And you could hear it there. Also looking at a waxwing, it's kind of gray on the back and wings, yellow belly, kind of a brownish head with a really clear black stripe there, and maybe a little bit of red on the wing sometimes.
Yeah, apparently. That's where the name waxwing comes from. There's a little bit of reddish. It looks like it was dipped in wax, mm-hmm. and then a yellow band across the tail.
Yes.
The very terminal tip of the tail. Those are the full adult plumages.
Oh, yeah. It's beautiful. Let's go ahead now and go to Larry in Menasha. Larry, what's your question today as we talk about birds?
Oh, yes. Hi. Bill, question.
Mm-hmm.
A couple times I was out on Lake Winnebago and saw a spring migration of gull-type birds and the first week in May.
Are these the ones with the black head?
That's the one.
Yeah.
Can you identify that?
Very good.
Thousands of them.
Yes, that is the Bonaparte's gull. Now, Bonaparte's gulls, some of them will hang out along the Lake Michigan and Great Lakes shores in the wintertime. They lose the black head at that time. There's just a dark spot, grayish smudge behind the eye. But that's the spring plumage for the adults. And they will migrate north into the spruce forests, and I've actually come across them in the Hudson Bay lowlands. Very odd for a gull. They nest in the tops of spruce trees. But when they're coming through in migration, they can concentrate in big numbers. And we can hear here, it's a different call, a little more scratchy call than the normal, what we think of as the gull call. And that's usually what we associate with the ringbill and herring gulls. So it's a very small gull and, yeah, all dark head. And when they come through, it's a very short time in late April, early May. We can get some pretty big flocks, and they'll quickly pass through the area and head up to the nesting ground. So they're widely scattered in wintertime. All of a sudden, they make these concentrated flocks, will pass through these areas, and then they're gone.
Wow, quite a sight. And I bet a sound. Think of that in the hundreds or thousands
yes.
of that call. Yeah. Quite a lot of noise there. All right. Sounds good. Thank you so much, Larry, for bringing that up. We really appreciate it. Let's go to Russ in Stoughton now. Russ, thanks for joining us today.
Hi. I had a couple of questions, but also one other question came up with your previous caller about waxwings. I had a flock of them here through the woods in my backyard maybe 2 years ago, and they were dark green, same size as cardinals with a tuft on the head, and I thought those were waxwings. They were completely dark green. There was no yellow on the tails.
Probably not waxwings then, huh? Well, or at least not the variety we're talking
about. Got the little crest on the head with the dark through the eyes. It's more of a tawny brown color on the body. I can't think of any other bird with the prominent crest.
Hmm.
It's usually not that a widespread sort of ornamentation.
Okay.
Cardinals, blue jays will raise a crest. A few birds that actually have that.
Right.
Be my most likely guess, though.
And those would not be confused by any means with what we're
talking about. No, but my most likely guess is does sound more like cedar waxwing to me.
All right. Yeah. Okay. And, Russ, you had a question about woodpeckers or a story?
Juncos. You know, juncos show up here normally, but there hasn't been any snow in the last 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
They show up in maybe October, late October, and then they're gone by April. And I'm
correct.
Wondering, if they come here only in the winter, where do they go then in April? If that's winter, wherever they go, why do they come here?
They're a relatively short-distance migrant. Now, some junco populations will go all the way down to Texas in wintertime, but it is really, for most of Wisconsin, a winter bird. But in far northeastern Wisconsin and into southern Canada is really their nesting range. So we do get a little bit of nesting right in the far northern tier of the state. But for the rest of us, it's a summer bird or a winter bird. And as you are correct, that they do come down fairly early into the fall time, but they're scattered out in the countryside. It isn't until we get a good snow cover they're forced to come into the backyard to our feeders to look for food.
Ah, all right. Let's fit in one more call here. Jim from Wauwatosa. Jim, what are you wondering today?
Well, I'm wondering about water for birds, especially here in the Milwaukee area.
Mm-hmm.
It's been dry and sunny and no snow cover. And if you don't have a heated bird bath, everything's frozen. How long can birds go without water?
Well, like anything, water is going to be important for maintaining their body condition. The fortunate thing is because birds do fly, they can cover pretty big areas in the daytime. So as they're looking for those resources, they should be able to find that somewhere in their daily rounds. You know, if it's not, something that you notice right in your own backyard that seems to be available, they'll certainly be able to find it somewhere.
Well, and Reva emailed to ask, too, about heated bird baths for winter, if there are certain types or that are best, or if there is a particular location we could be putting them in. What's your take on that?
Anywhere out in the backyard, next to the bird feeder somewhere. As far as varieties, I think the best thing is take a look at something that fits your budget. There may be a little bit of concern when it gets well below zero. Should we be exposing birds to open water? That's a little still open for debate. But otherwise, it is important attractant for the birds. And along with that, a variety of food. And don't forget to landscape your yard. And as I always remind people right now, when everything is as bare as possible, something you might want to do is take a look around your backyard for your spring planting plans. What can you do to make your backyard more bird friendly?
Oh, okay.
And with the upcoming Christmas season, think also, what can you buy somebody to enhance their birding enjoyment? A field guide, an identification book, a good pair of binoculars, bird feeder, bird bath. Those make great gifts, something that have somebody else to take a little bit of a greater interest in our birds, because we never take care of things that we're not interested in, and we're not going to protect what we don't love. So we need a little bit of more of an attachment and introduction to birds, especially if some of the kids get them out there to enjoy birds and actually even be aware of birds in the environment and make sure that we have some future conservationists that build on what we've done.
And so you can start building that connection right now. We talked earlier about the fact that we've lost so many birds in the last 50 years. That's what the data is showing us.
Yes.
I mean, is that one of the ways to reverse the trend, make that connection?
Well, we do know this. Through conservation efforts, we have rebuilt populations.
Mm-hmm.
Look at what we've done for turkeys. Canada geese, believe it or not, 60 years ago, were extremely rare. Now they're almost a nuisance. Our waterfowl populations, these have increased. These have rebounded. We can save birds and we can rebuild them. And that's the good news. We just have to make an effort and have to make sure that we consider birds to be important in the environment and we want to keep them here. Because right now, it used to be nature was taking care of it. They're in our hands. They're our fate. Nature will take care of them, but we have to take care of nature. If we don't do that, not only are the birds in trouble, but I think we are too.
Bill, thank you so much for your time today.
Always a pleasure. I really enjoyed the invitation. Thanks.
Bill Volkert is a retired wildlife educator and naturalist, worked at the Horicon Marsh for 27 years, and he's been watching birds for well over 40, sighted more than 3,750 of them. Jill Nadeau is our producer here. Tyler Ditter is operating the board for us. I'm Keely Boltina, and I want to say thank you for joining us right here on the Ideas Network.